I'll start with a brief recapitulation. Did I get that right? A recapitulation of what I talked about yesterday. So I'm talking about the five niyamas, the five regularities within reality. Yesterday I laid out the basic theory, if you like. I'm going to go a little bit more into that today, and then I'm going to look at how that affects spiritual life and practice today. Tomorrow I'm going to look at how that affects society, social action, and I'm going to tell you how to vote. I'm joking, I assure you. I have no idea, but I'm going to look at what at least applying this sort of Buddhist map, a responsible government should be attending to, and then you can make up your own minds. It's not up to me. Well, it is, but only one vote. So the five niyamas, niyama means order, really. And niyamata means orderliness, regularity. So we know that the fundamental teaching of Buddhism is that everything arises in dependence on conditions. That there's no knowable phenomenon that does not have arise out of antecedent conditions, but does not itself provide the conditions for something else to arise. There's nothing outside us, nothing inside us that evades that law. There's nothing that's permanent, nothing that's independent. Everything comes into being because of previous conditions, passes away when those conditions cease, and itself gives rise to new conditions. But that law of conditionality displays regularities. You can see patterns of conditioned arising. If you examine phenomenon, you can see that certain things happen repeatedly. Certain conditions give rise to certain effects. And, with all sorts of provisos of accurate observation and elimination of other possibilities, you can then see that there's some sort of pattern, even some law, you might say. One possible translation of niyama is law. Law, of course, in the scientific sense, rather than in the legal sense. A regularity. Things happen according to regular patterns. And according to Buddhist doctrine, that is the nature of reality. It's a conditioned arising which has regularities, that happens according to ordered patterns. It's quite important. The Buddhist theory is that reality is not random, on the one hand. It's not that something can happen one way and one time and another way another time, with the same conditions. It's not random, it's not chaotic. At the same time, it's not externally ordered. There's nothing outside reality that determines the way in which things happen. There are, as it were, built into the way things are, regularities. This is why some people refer to Buddhism as being scientific, in the sense that it tries to discern the regularities within experience. Only in that sense, is not materialist, as we'll see. So the Buddha talked in a very general way about these regularities. He talked about various different patterns of regularity, and he never came up with any overall system, as far as I've ever discovered. But later commentarial tradition took from what the Buddha said a number of discernible orders of pattern, you know, a bit like you used to have the kingdoms in sort of early science, you know, the mineral kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, and so on. So these really are kind of orders of conditionality, which quite closely corresponds to the patterns that Buddhist theory distinguishes. So it starts with the mineral kingdom, if you like, the physical inorganic order. Uttu means something like matter, a bit more complicated than that, but it'll do. So the Uttu Niyama is the set of regularities within reality as a whole which govern inorganic matter, gravity. Any scientists here can help me out? That sort of thing. How about that? So the laws of physics, the laws of chemistry. Put two H's together with an O and you get water. That sort of thing. So yes, the laws of physics and chemistry. Then the Bija Niyama is the laws that govern organic substances, organic matter, organisms, systems, organized systems that have an enduring identity, at least for a period of time, which are organized for their survival and often reproduction. So it's photosynthesis and so on. It's the lower dimension of organic matter, which has its own regularities. It can be studied through biology, through botany, and so on. Then you can see that there's a progression. The physical inorganic laws begin to form themselves into complex wholes that are organized for survival and for reproduction, which amounts to the Bija Niyama, the organic order of regularity. It's quite important. There is a sort of evolutionary progression through the niyamas. The organic order then gains in complexity, and a certain degree of intelligence emerges, at least sensitivity emerges, which is capable of considerable sophistication before it amounts to self-consciousness. So, as I mentioned yesterday, it's instinct, really. It's that order of regularity which governs instinctual behaviour, that governs the mind in the sense of stimulus response, the mind in the sense of instinct. So it's the animal kingdom, the ordering that belongs to, that's studied in zoology and so on, those sort of sciences. Manu means literally mind, but here it's very definitely mind in the, if you like, lower sense, in the instinctual sense, which can be extremely sophisticated. Of course, yes, we can see again the progression that the organic organization attains a sophistication that brings about patterns of instinct. The patterns of instinct themselves become more sophisticated and develop an ability to be self-identified. The instinctive mental functioning, the instinctive sensitivity, becomes aware of itself. The organism identifies itself. Self-consciousness emerges. Once self-consciousness emerges, a new kind of relationship develops with the surrounding environment. A relationship in which the individual, because you can now talk of an individual in a sense, the self-conscious identity measures itself, identifies itself, chooses in relation to its environment, his or her environment indeed. And this brings into play the order of conditionality, which is known as karma, or karma, we're more familiar with it as. Karma simply means action, but it means the action that emerges from a degree of self-identification. The point at which you say, I and not I. I in relation to world. And once that distinction emerges, once that self-identity emerges, an enduring sense of yourself in time, an enduring sense of your separation from something else in space, the actions that you perform in relation on the basis of that self-identification has an impact internally, and of course it has an impact externally, but the impact that it has is related to the quality of the mind that performs it. So as this dimension of conditionality emerges, ethics comes into play. A mind that's dominated by the states of mind of craving, of hatred, or of a refusal to see what is there, brings about states of internal pain, of unfulfillment, of stultification, of further frustration, and so forth, and may even provoke reactions from the world around that are proportionate to the mental state. States of mind of love, of well-wishing, bring about an internal sense of satisfaction, of ease, of innocence. States of generosity and fellow feeling, you might say, bring about a greater and greater sense of ease and internal satisfaction. A state of awareness brings about a greater degree of inner enjoyment and pleasure and enjoyment of the world around. We'll look a bit more at this in a moment because this is obviously a key. This may also be reflected in the way in which the world responds back. Sometimes in a very obvious way, you hit somebody, they hit you back. You smile at them and they're more likely to smile back at you. But it may be, according to Buddhist tradition, quite mysterious and even longer acting. Actions that you performed in the past may re-emerge later in quite unidentifiable ways. That's much more mysterious, much more risky to speculate about. So much to be said about the principle of karma, but I'm only wanting to remind you all. I hope that you all are vaguely familiar with it. Of course, it's perhaps the most important thing for us primarily to be aware of. What is it that creates a sense of inner happiness and fulfillment? Whatever, regardless of external circumstances, it is the quality of our willing, the quality of our volition. This is good Buddhist theory, but there's quite a bit of growing evidence to suggest that this is the case from the new science of hedonics emerging, interestingly, out of economics. That it's values that create an inner sense of satisfaction, and that the breaking of values that creates an inner sense of dissatisfaction and pain and disappointment and frustration and so on. So karma is the distinctively human dimension emerges with self-consciousness, which creates a relationship with the world around you based upon your self-identification, your sense of yourself as an enduring agent and also center of experience. And that then is a strong factor in determining your inner satisfaction or dissatisfaction. Sometimes even in contrariety to what you're experiencing externally. You can be in very bad situations and experience a great deal of inner sense of satisfaction and fulfillment. And you can be in very, very pleasant and pleasurable circumstances, you know, very wealthy and with everything you want, and sense an inner sense of stultification and dissatisfaction, self-disappointment. Of course, you know, you can also gain some satisfaction from material benefit. Don't want to deny that. But kamma is the principal determinant of your inner satisfaction. And beyond that is this rather mysterious dimension of conditionality known as dhamma niyama. Much harder to talk about because for most of us it's only something that we've had some glimpses of. But it's that regularity built into reality that makes Buddhahood possible, that makes spiritual progress in its higher senses possible. That the reality that we inhabit, there isn't another one by the way, the reality that we inhabit is constructed in such a way that Buddhahood is possible. It's a permanent, enduring possibility which emerges once a self-conscious individual develops a certain degree of sensitivity, which we'll say more about in a while. And it operates well, in a different way to kamma. Kamma operates by virtue of individual intention. In other words, there's a certain degree of self-conscious volition, willing. But the Dhamma Niyama is transpersonal. It begins to emerge within you as something that's more than you. That's the sort of experience that you have. You read, dipping into William James' classic Varieties of Religious Experience. It's really fascinating material because he was attempting, as the first person really to attempt, a sort of scientific study of religious experience. And so much of what you read there, of course, comes from a Christian context, but quite a lot comes from a totally secular context. People who are not thinking in those terms at all, or are thinking in more cultural, poetic terms, or artistic terms, aesthetic terms. And that the constant theme of this is that something begins to emerge within their experience which has a dynamic. It's not just a sort of static flash, it's a sort of force, you could say, you know, analogically, or metaphorically, a force that emerges within consciousness that seems to sort of carry you, the individual, beyond the individual. So the Dhamma Niyama is that regularity, that set of patterns, that ordering within reality that begins to come into play when the individual gains a certain degree of self-transcendence. I'm going to have to say more about this in a while. But a certain degree of looking beyond self, recognition even of the limitations of the notion of self, a recognition that the nice firm boundaries that there seem to be between us and other things are not so so clear-cut. Taking some inspiration from a luncheon date today. You know, you're breathing, and it seems that, you know, it's my breath. But when you actually begin to watch your breath, as we try to teach ourselves to do here in this very shrine room, you begin to notice that the breath, in a way, has very little to do with you. You can sort of do the breathing for a bit, but you soon hyperventilate and collapse if you keep on trying to do it. Which can be exciting, but you can't sustain it. You can't stop the breath. you know, you remember children saying, if you don't give me another pudding, I will hold my breath, and then you'll be sorry. Like, you know, you can safely say to them, okay, go ahead, because they won't succeed. Because the breathing is not really yours. It happens of its own accord. And one of the fascinating things is you begin to sort of really focus on the breath, is you have a sort of sense of the breathing just going on. You're simply aware of it. That's the only thing you can contribute. And even that the boundaries of the breath begin to dissolve. That, well, in a way, it's almost more as much that the breath is coming into your body as that you're taking it in. You know the sort of thing. You've probably all had some experiences of this kind. So you begin to push beyond a very embounded view of yourself as separate from the world around you, and you begin to see it's much more malleable, much more fluid, much more mentally constructed, even choices. Weird things, choices, aren't they? I constantly refer to this. I did a long solitary retreat a couple of years ago, and I decided that I began to investigate decisions. And one of the most difficult decisions was how to get out of bed in the morning. I know that everybody has this problem, but when you're alone, and you know, I was alone for 5 months, so there was nobody to know what I was doing. I could lie in bed all day long if I wanted, and I did. confession. I just began to sort of think, well, what is it that actually, why get out of bed now rather than now? And, you know, who is it that makes a decision? What makes a decision? So I'd lie there in a sort of choiceless paralysis, unable to work out how to get out of bed. And then I'd suddenly find myself in the toilet having a pee. And I really never made the decision. You can extrapolate whole spiritual theories out of this. Anyway, you get the point. That what seem to be simple, hard and fast boundaries, simply, you know, have a simple model of me, an enduring, somehow stable entity within a somewhat fluid environment, me kind of coming to independent decisions as if I'm floating above reality, insert myself into reality and decide what to do, all begins to break down. All sorts of different circumstances can bring that about. And you sense something else at play. Something I mean that is, it can be quite disturbing, but which is undeniably constructive, positive, well, creative. And that when you're able to give yourself up to it, leads to intense joy, intense satisfaction, and a sense of flowing with what is most fundamental to things. That's the Dhamma Niyama. We get flashes of it, probably flashes of the Dhamma Niyama arising for us that brought us into a place like this. You get some intimation, immortality, that makes you want to take it further, want to develop it further. And it's universal. It's found in all religions, it's found in non-religions, it's found in all cultures. It's nothing to do with any particular theory, if you like. It's not Buddhist. It's not Christian or Muslim or whatever. It will emerge within all those traditions and within none of them. It's something implicit in the nature of things, implicit in the nature of consciousness, you might say, consciousness being part of things themselves, the things as a whole. The Dhamma Niyama brings, as it unfolds, as you naturally align yourself with it, and begin to allow it to unfold within you. That's all we can do, is get out of its way as you get out of its way and it begins to unfold within you, yes, it leads to a stronger and stronger sense of rightness, of appropriateness. Very, very difficult to know how to talk about it. And you can see the Buddha himself in the early scriptures struggling to find out how to express it. He came from a context in which a great deal was said about the ultimate of things. The early history of Indian religious philosophy is highly speculative and highly abstract. And the Buddha clearly considered that this was problematic, that the very speculative and abstract nature of religious thought was itself a problem, because it led to what we call reification. You know, those Latin scholars amongst you will hear the word thing. Res means a thing. It led to a thingification of sort of ultimate matters, treating them as if they were tables and chairs and ordinary things within concrete reality. So it tends to reduce experience. You have an experience of something that goes further than your ordinary world, and you need to find some way of talking about it. So you erect a structure of thought and of language that perhaps does some service in expressing it, but which solidifies, and the Buddha said, denies that experience itself. Very quickly it comes to deny it. The Buddha talked about it as these theories as drishti. Drishti meaning view. So he said that all these views are contaminated by interest, so that you have some glimpse, maybe, of something that goes further. It may be that you just think your way into it. It may be that you have some kind of, if you like, mystical experience of it. But you've got some interest, some personal interest. And that personal interest determines the view that you impose upon that experience and fixes it, so that the experience is sort of caged. And he said that he has no views. What he tries to do is describe, you could say, the raw experience and give only a description of the circumstances, the conditions under which it arises. And in this sense, I think that at least classical Buddhism, the early Buddhism, is very, very distinctive. Some of you remember my first rambles around reality of 7 years ago, whatever it was, where I talked about the Buddha's metaphysical reticence, a famous metaphysical reticence. He refused to give too much abstract content to these experiences that we're here calling, defining, or referring to through the Dhamma Niyama. He simply said that these experiences are the end of suffering, at least not in the physical sense. When you've got a body, you can't evade it, but of mental suffering. They're the end of the turbulence of craving, the turbulence of hatred, and the constant frustration of misknowing, of ignorance. So he described the experience mainly in negative terms of what it wasn't. Described it in terms of images, of the cool caves, a rather lovely one. Doesn't quite work in England. Like the refreshing rain, which again doesn't work in England. It works really well in India. If you've ever been in India in May, and where it's really stinking hot and you're waiting for the monsoon, you know what nirvana is, what it is to long for nirvana. Nirvana itself means the blowing out, or the cooling down, sometimes translated as. So a whole range of metaphors which are given the Buddha avoided giving any metaphysical content to it, and he refused metaphysical speculation. So he was asked various things about, for instance, what happens to a Buddha after death, and he said, you can't say he is, you can't say he isn't, you can't say he is and isn't, and that he neither is nor isn't. Not much left to say. So in other words, he said it defies our understanding, and that an attempt to impose words upon it restricts and limits it, and also leaves it prey to possession. As I was saying yesterday, I've been dipping into modern Shiism, trying to learn some lessons from the Ayatollahs. And what you can clearly see is the taking of what are obviously really genuine experiences and the imposing upon them of a legalistic framework where some people become authorities for them, which can lead to terrible suffering. And, you know, we've got the history of Europe to also demonstrate it. Yeah.
Just wonder, because sometimes the Dhamma Nyama can seem very much like the light council and the other council. And I don't know whether this all happened to me, but, you know, the choicelessness you talked about, well, isn't limited to my individual choices and my individual. So if one's at ease and flowing with that choicelessness,
sure. Yeah, we'll be going into this a little later. Yeah, I'm trying at the moment just to give a picture of it. So the Buddha had this sort of metaphysical reticence where he resisted giving a philosophical content to this experience, but he was also very conscious of the opposite danger, which is of leaving it as such a big blank that you think it's a big emptiness. And this is perhaps partly what one starts to fear when you feel that you're slipping away. And we will touch on this a bit later. So he said that there's a danger of over-concretizing, but there's a danger of what he called nihilism, of denying that ultimate experience, that higher experience, any reality. So you think of it as a big blank. It's the old thing. I remember the very first retreat I went on, going to Sangharakshita and saying, Buddhism teaches the end of self. And I said, I want more self. I don't feel I'm self enough. He just laughed, and I sort of got the message. There's a danger that you give it too much content, and there's a danger that you give it too little content. And so the sort of things that the Buddha did would talk about it as a positive experience, but without giving it a very concrete definition. Talking about it as the ending of the negative, painful experiences that we can have, and talking about it in metaphorical terms. I think probably the dangers of nihilism are stronger than ever, especially in our highly materialist age, where with the power of modern science and our strong rejection of the evils of religious systems with their ecclesiastical impositions, has left us much more vulnerable to the nihilistic dimension, perhaps, than the eternalist in Buddhist language. So it's very difficult to know how to talk about this dimension. But perhaps the best way to talk about it is something like this, as a pattern of conditioning that we can touch on, and that we can feel ourselves being carried along by, and that if we allow ourselves to go with, once we recover from the shock, will carry us on to greater and greater fulfillment. A lot more to be said about that, but what I want to do now is look at how in Sangharakshita's teaching we use these niyamas, we approach these niyamas, And I hope that will begin to give us something more concrete to talk about, including the kind of, sometimes shocking experiences that can come from some contact with the Dhamma Niyama. So the broad approach that Sagaracitta teaches, and that is the core of the teaching mostly taught at a place like this, is in terms of five stages, four stages, and a sort of non-stage that accompanies the four stages. I'm going to talk about the four stages first, and have to bring in the non-stage later, but don't forget the non-stage, it's there. So his system begins with what he calls a stage of integration. So here you can see that in the evolutionary process, at the stage of Kama Niyama, self-consciousness emerges. But that self-consciousness, to begin with, is quite crude, sort of fixed, quite unsophisticated, not very complex, not doing full justice to the complexity of experience, not taking in even the full range of one's own experience. So to begin with, one needs to experience what actually is there, going on, so to speak, within one, although it's not really within one, but what appears to be one. So you need to take in the lower niyamas. You need to take in those niyamas as they manifest within you. That's in a way what we were doing at the start of this session. Just being mindful of sparsha, as contact within the body. The contact of the, which is really to do with these three lower niyamas. You can't isolate them so easily here, but you know, the skin contacts the wood of the chair. That sends signals through the nerves, which presumably are more to do with the bija niyama. The whole mental system constructs of those the signals sent by the nerves a pattern, a picture of what's going on. But quite often we're not fully aware of that. We're not really taking that sufficiently into account. We impose upon it an idea of the body, which is not related to how the body actually is. So we according to fundamental Buddhist theory, we need to start by being mindful of what actually is going on. What's going on in our bodies, what our feeling responses are to those sensations, which integrates the lower niyamas, you might say. We identify those niyamas as they work within us, and in a sense also learn to disentangle ourselves a bit from them, so that we're not so our idea of ourselves is not so exclusively bound up. Sorry, I'm just a bit sort of got a bit of a feeling I might be going too fast. How are you doing? Yeah? Maybe it's going on. Yeah, you all right? So, the stage of integration, which is characterized by especially mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the overall condition of the mind, mindfulness of the processes going on within one, mindfulness, especially in the form of mindfulness of breathing, as a means of integrating one's awareness around a fairly stable experience. But that's where classically the whole spiritual path starts, because it's very difficult to move any further without really being properly self-aware. But that self-awareness then needs to be made richer and deeper, and this is done through cultivating skillful intention. We sometimes refer to it as positive emotion, but I think the word emotion is too fuzzy in English. And it's really a question of learning to cultivate helpful attitudes. The Buddhist word is kushala, which literally means skillful in the craft sense. I sometimes think that's almost too hackneyed now and doesn't really convey a full enough meaning. It's a good word if you sort of analyse it, but I've come to think that really a better word would be helpful and unhelpful intentions. Again, because it helps to remove it from the context of moral good and bad in the old sense, in the God and all that sort of sense. So it's intentions that are helpful to you, helpful to the world around you. Helpful in the sense of working with Kamma. So you cultivate those through ethics, through Shila, through thinking intelligently about your actions, looking at your motivations, examining the situation clearly, and trying to connect with a helpful intention, as helpful an intention as you can for yourself and for as broad a range of others as you can. We classically develop that, yes, through the practice of the precepts. The precepts are merely guides to helpful action. You can check your actions as helpful or unhelpful through referring to the precepts and through the cultivation of metta, Maitri Bhavana. Maitri being a helpful intention, the most helpful intention that you can develop. It's not a feeling. Sometimes we get caught out because we think it's about nice feelings. It will be under the law of karma, but initially it's to do with intentions that are helpful. And so you're aligning yourself in this stage more and more with Kamma. You're learning to bring your own actions into harmony with this fundamental sort of moral principle that's built into the universe. The universe is, from this point of view, moral. It's a moral character, which doesn't mean that everything that happens is for the best, as it were. But it means that helpful action leads to growing inner satisfaction. Unhelpful action leads to an inner sense of frustration and poverty. Helpful action of body, speech and mind begins to lend greater depth and aesthetic satisfaction to your experience. This is an important dimension of skillful action, that as you act more skillfully, your experience broadens. The whole realm of dhyana and so forth in Buddhist theory, these higher states of consciousness, emerge quite naturally. They're not to be grabbed at, but they emerge out of your skillful intentions. As you act more skillfully, well, the world becomes richer. You become more sensitive to what's around you, because you're more and more open to what's around you. So that you see the beauty of things, you see also the suffering in things. You see the humanity in others. You overcome your narrow, prejudiced cultural patterns. You begin to be more human in your responses. And it's a natural unfoldment under the law of karma. Very, very straightforward in the Buddhist scriptures. I mean, it's straightforward to say it. Not so straightforward to do it, of course. But it's an important point about karma. That karma doesn't just bring you do something good so you get a reward. But it amplifies, it extends, it broadens, it heightens your sensitivity. So that you become more and more awake to the finer things. Your sensibility wakes up. And it's interesting, but although you can have an aesthetic sense without a moral sense, I don't think you can sustain it. And that aesthetic sense is usually tainted in some way. There's, you know, it's a whole other question which I won't go into now. But broadly speaking, the aesthetic and the moral sense are closely connected. They're to do with a gradual amplification of consciousness, a sensitizing of consciousness, a refining of consciousness under the action of the law of karma. If you simply work at developing more and more skillful intentions, gradually your consciousness will emerge in a more ample, a more sensitive way. Put it like that. The Buddha, in the classic text, the Samanapala Sutta, in Digha Nikaya of the Sutta Pitaka, the earliest body of material of the Buddha's teachings, he talks about the way in which, first of all, you engage in skillful action, and he gives various lists of precepts, which all sort of sum up from different points of view what skillful action means. Then he says, as a result of that skillful action, you will become happy. If you become happy, you become concentrated. If you become concentrated, you experience a much broader and deeper range of consciousness. So it's a chain, a conditioned pattern. So following on from the stage of integration, the stage of development of helpful intentions, the stage of developing skillful karma that leads to a broadening and deepening of consciousness. Without that broadening and deepening of consciousness, it's very, very difficult to even feel the touch of the Dhamma Niyama, the touch of this other dimension. You just don't get it. It's there all the time, of course, but you just don't sense it within you because your mind is too crude, too harsh. Your self-identification is too narrow and rigid. So as under the law of karma, you develop greater flexibility of mind. The mind becomes, in the words of the suttas, pliable, flexible, malleable, workable, wieldy. Something else begins to come into play. But in the system that is the core of what we do, it's sort of necessary to learn to accept that. Because, as Jayachitta was, I think, getting at before I rudely interrupted her, the Dhamma Niyama can emerge within you, and its emergence, it's so alien in a way, so denying of who you think you are, that it can seem overwhelming, terrifying, and even acutely painful, frightening. I think quite often people's first experiences of the Dhamma Niyama beginning to sort of, well, be conscious of that Dhamma Niyama is not a particularly pleasant one, or a rather mixed one, hot and cold. You sense something really important and meaningful, but it's a no. Even you can sometimes find in meditation that may begin to unfold for you, and a door slams. You don't even deliberately do it, so to speak. It just slams. You don't want it. So you have to learn to let go. You have to learn to let go of your main way of identifying yourself. So we train ourselves, well, in a way you could say, to die. Because for the Dhamma Niyama to unfold, you have to die to the lower Niyamas. In other words, you have to let go of your idea of yourself in the terms of these lower Niyamas. We identify ourselves as a body. We identify ourselves as an agent and as a centre of experience. And that's, well, often very, very important to us. And of course, that identification of ourselves is then added to with cultural identifications, with family identifications, psychological identifications, some of which, even though they're very painful, are extremely strongly attached to. So we need to learn to let go. We need to learn, in the classic language, to die. Partly because we are going to die, so we need to learn to do it before we get there, and it's not too overwhelming and terrifying. But we need to learn to die because unless we can die to our old self-identification, we cannot allow something new to emerge within us. And this is true at every level, isn't it? Even at the level of growing up. You know, you have to die as a child to become an adult. And sometimes that can be something one's reluctant to do, to let go of parents or whatever. But this is a big one, a big death. And in the Buddhist tradition, there are many, many methods for learning to die. We teach a principal one, which is very closely connected to the pattern of the Niyamas, in which you recognize the elements within you. You recognize the earth element within you, that your body is made up of solid matter. And you learn to recognize that that solid matter within you is not who you are, because it's changing all the time. It's not something stable. You can't fix onto it. And in the end, you've got to give it up. You didn't bring it with you. You can't take it with you when you go. So you learn to just let it be there, but hang loose to it. You're aware of it, but you're not identified with it. You train yourself to let go, to give up the earth element. And then the same for water, blood, and so forth, to fire, the heat in the body, to air, the breath and the various gases in the body, to the space that you occupy. And then to recognize that consciousness is something not just bound up with these elements. Consciousness is something that is unbounded, that is mysterious, that is not identified, it's not mine. You learn to let consciousness unfold in accordance with a new dimension, within the dimension of the Dhamma Niyama. So we train ourselves in spiritual death. You deliberately learn to let go of your narrow identification, your over-identification, especially with the physical body, with consciousness as a unified identity. And you learn to just experience, just to be open to what experience is, to let experience unfold without claiming it, without saying it's mine. So the third stage is the stage of spiritual death. Integration, you learn to really see where you are bound up with the Niyamas, with a stage of helpful intentions, of positive emotion. You learn to act in a skillful way, in a helpful way, that of course has its own benefit because it's good for others, but which also allows your own experience to unfold in a more and more rich and open and sensitive way. Then you need to learn to die, to let go of it, which can be facing up to terror. I don't know, but it's an experience that comes to different people in different ways and for different reasons. It depends, for instance, the extent to which you have some sense of something beyond yourself. Some people have a strong sort of faith, if you like, in something that goes beyond themselves. A lot of people, particularly in the modern world, identify so closely with the material world that the idea of giving it up is just terrifying. So it's different for different people. It's sometimes said that some people move backwards towards the Dhamma Niyama and some people go forwards towards it, if you see what I mean. Some people go lovingly towards it and some people go screaming and kicking and resisting all the way. You know your own type. Or probably it's sometimes one, sometimes the other. But you need to very deliberately disentangle yourself from the very narrow identification that you have. And this allows a new stage to unfold, which is what our teacher has called the stage of spiritual rebirth. So that something remains. What it is best left to experience. But something remains. Something unfolds. The Dhamma Niyama unfolds when you leave space. If you don't leave space, it can't unfold. If it does come, you'll resist it. You'll fight it off. You'll experience it as overwhelming, as terrifying. I think this is what you were getting at. Is it? You can say in a minute. you give the space for it to unfold, and you embrace it willingly, gladly, and recognizing it as something that is connected with the ultimate meaning of things, connected with the deepest meaning of things, with the highest satisfaction and enjoyment, and the fulfillment of your life, and which you are content to give yourself up to, you could say. It's represented in our tradition, especially by the visualization of the Buddha and other ideal Buddha figures, which sort of embody this unfolding dimension of reality. Because the Buddha, for us, is the one who had fully allowed that Dhamma Niyama to emerge within him. So our system has these four levels, which, of course, they don't necessarily come in a nice, neat, orderly way according to the way the system goes. And you may find different stages emerge within you in a disorderly fashion according to your past actions and so forth. But in the end, they'll all need to unfold. But that presents the whole process in terms of a deliberate intentions that you formulate, deliberate practice that you undertake. But that's only 50% of what spiritual practice is concerned with. You could say there's another 50% which is not active, but receptive. At every stage, these need to be accompanied by receptivity. So at every stage, you need to accompany the stage of integration with just opening up to what emerges from that stage. The stage of skillful intention needs to be accompanied by just opening up to what emerges. You need to sit with what is in order to allow it to unfold. If you're constantly pushing and grabbing at it, it won't happen. So we say that at every stage you need to accompany the practices that embody that stage with the practice of just sitting. So I hope you now get some idea of how these niyamas are related to the basic practice as we understand it in Sri Ratna, as we are now called as of today. I realise I've not left much time for follow-up, but what time there is, let's see what follow-up there is.
I suppose the first thing is integration.
Yes. Well, it's generally referred to as positive emotion, but I've taken the liberty of calling it helpful or skillful intention, because I think that's clearer. And then the third is spiritual death, and the fourth is spiritual rebirth. So there's a definite sense that something remains. What exactly it is, you have to experience. Yeah? And each of those stages is accompanied by just sitting, by opening up. Yes.
And you
yeah.
should be going towards it, not running away.
Yeah. Yes. Well, in a way, you can't know, and perhaps you just have to have a bit more sort of confidence in yourself and in the nature of things. but that may be hard to come by. So I think it's a sort of basic Buddhist point of view is that whatever experience is there, if you face it in an open way, it cannot harm you. So you need to have that sort of faith as you go into experiences, and there's nothing that can unfold within you you can't face. So what you need to do is strengthen your faith, strengthen your confidence, perhaps partly by, you know, association with people who've been there, or at least to a greater extent than you, and who have you know, some ease about that. I've often found that, you know, not that I claim very great experience, that people will come to me saying that, you know, something overwhelming has happened to them, and either thinking that they've just gained enlightenment, which is another danger, or thinking that you know, they're just about to become possessed by the devil. And I say, oh, that, you know, because it's not unfamiliar to me. Again, I'm not saying that I've experienced very much, but. You know, you go to people who have a confidence in that sort of experience. You read the Buddhist texts which describe that experience. So you need to build up quite a bit of faith. And I think that's one of our problems, that we come to the practice of Buddhism from a culture which has undermined faith in reality, where we see reality as cold, as impersonal, as, in a sense, ultimately blank. So we need to sort of build up a stronger sense of confidence in reality, a sense that it's ultimately benign. This is what this formulation shows us, that built into reality is a moral dimension and a spiritual dimension. So, yes, when the experience comes, well, first of all, if you've got the time to say, calm down, don't worry, you do that. What you can do is come back and go through the stages to sort of settle yourself in your body, settle yourself with skillful intention, and so on. So we generally say that you do need to build up the basis. I've seen what happens to people sometimes. They get you know, an overwhelming experience of reality. I remember this myself with drugs, with LSD. I took drugs. Dumb dinner. Oh no, didn't inhale. That was not what we did with them. Dumb dinner, you know. You swallowed that blotting paper. I was there. I saw you. But, you know, you're not really ready for it. You are, in a way, flung up against raw reality. But it's a really, in my own case, not in Dhammadinas, a really callow youth with quite a bit of unconfidence and inexperience, and he just couldn't handle it. So, you know, you need to put effort into building the basis. But be constantly open to learning how to open up to what you don't know.
Isn't this faith common to any other religions anyway?
Yes.
Christianity.
Yeah. Well, in a way, yes, I'd agree with you. But the issue for us is that is the question of the way in which it's talked about. So Buddhism has a critique of, as I've already said, of views, which are, first of all, easily reified, which easily become assimilated to structures of power and control and of limitation. Not that Buddhism is in itself open to this, but the way that Buddhism criticizes other views, or views in general, is quite important, the major difference between Buddhism and other religions. Buddhism wouldn't say that people from other religions do not have access to these unfolding dimensions. But it would say that the way in which we think about those, and the way we structure them, affects how they unfold. Even within Buddhism, there are tendencies to reify which can even nullify the experience. So in Buddhism, one of the key contributions of Buddhism, I think, to world spiritual culture is its critique of language, the language of spiritual experience. But yes, I would say that other religions definitely have access to these sort of experiences. And you can hear it when you hear people talking, and people from no religion. The key question is how you think about it. Because the way you think, to some extent, determines how the experience goes.
In order to reach that fifth stage and remain there quite a lot of the time, the idea of being death, allowing the body to fall away, allowing ego, personality, self-consciousness, self-reflecting tendency. I mean, is that possible within a domestic environment, or do we need to go into a monastery or order?
But just to be clear, our order is not a monastic order, so there are people who have families. It certainly is, of course, much easier when circumstances are built up to help you, to support you. But believe me, you can be just as stultified in a so-called supportive situation as not, because it can sort of overprotect you sometimes. When it's working well, it's very, very effective. In the Buddhist scriptures, there are a number of many cases of the Buddha's lay disciples who gained high attainments within the system. It certainly is more difficult because of two things. One, distraction. You know what I mean? It's very difficult to give the time to reflection and so forth. The second is attachment, the life of owning things and relationships of familiar relationships with people can be very strongly attaching. But it can also be an environment for work. You have to make it into that, for spiritual work, where you're working with skillful action, for instance. You're working with becoming more mindful, even working with spiritual death. And I'm very familiar with friends who live in those sort of situations, who make very considerable spiritual progress. So generally, we would say that if you can be in a situation which is more definitely sort of geared to spiritual progress, so much the better. If you can't, well, you need to work even harder to make that work. And you can. It can be done. Otherwise, we wouldn't bother to... We would, frisk you at the door to see whether you had a family. You see what I mean?
We need to receptivity at every stage.
Yes.
What are the regularities that relate to receptivity? Or do we need to consciously cultivate it or
It's odd, because to begin with, you may have to make a bit of an effort to be receptive. In other words, oh gosh, I'm sorry. neatly jumping out of the problem. It's a sort of faculty that you need to learn. To begin with, well, you could say, how do you be receptive? Well, be receptive. That's not very helpful. But I suppose what you would be doing is paying attention to what happens. So, for instance, do the mindfulness of breathing. When you finish the session of mindfulness of breathing, just watch what happens. If you've done it at all successfully, there will be slight change in your consciousness. So without thinking about it, without doing anything, see what happens. Let that happen. In certain situations, just sit with your experience. I remember very early in my time in the order, I got the best teaching of all, which was the spiritual benefit of boredom. Boredom, Sangharakshita said, was one of the most positive spiritual experiences you could have. So stay bored. Very, very easy for some. Very difficult for somebody like me who constantly easily finds distractions. But just stay bored. Don't try to escape it. Just stay with it and see what happens. So I think it's a question of seeing what happens much more. Doing a practice, then seeing what happens. Being on a train, nothing to do, see what happens. So I think that's perhaps that you need maybe that little clue. See what happens. Look at what unfolds. Be interested in it, but without a sort of forced effort. Just notice. Perhaps the sort of paradigm is aesthetic experience, where you see something that's really beautiful and you don't think about it. You don't think, oh, that's beautiful. You're just engaged. So there's much more to say, but that's a little clue. And I'm conscious that there's ravening hordes who've been stripped of their families waiting outside to...